I'm sorry I didn't come across this book earlier. I was listening to a podcast, Slate's Gabfest, and one of the hosts, David Plotz, was doing something called Cocktail Chatter. I don't know if you heard this story, but it's where at the end of the podcast, after dissecting the day's news, they do cocktail chatter. They say, what will you just be talking to your friends about? And Plotz says, well, I've just finished this book, and it's called Challenger. And he said it is just so riveting. And his enthusiasm for the book was so unbridled that I thought, okay, I got to get this book too. So, you know, months later now, I finally fall into the book. And now I've become David Plotz. I just come up to complete strangers on the street and say, have you read Challenger? It's the best damn book ever. So that brings me to you today.
Oh, well, thank you. And please don't stop doing that.
Yeah. How am I doing so far? Well, I will tell you this, too, and I don't know if you would agree with this, but I liken it in some ways to The Wager or The Wide, Wide Sea, which are these great adventure stories of science, hubris, personalities. And we have the same sort of dynamics in your book, don't we?
That's definitely the idea. I mean, that's part of what makes me interested in these stories in the first place.
Meaning stories like Chernobyl and now this, huh?
Well, they're based in human stories about people in a circumstance of extraordinary danger and jeopardy, but also at the intersection of human beings and technology.
Yeah. Well, this is that. Although still, why now? What drew you to this story at this particular time?
Well, partly because I had written the book about Chernobyl, which takes place in the early months of 1986. And when I was actually promoting that book, I was frequently asked if I remembered where I was when I heard the news about Chernobyl happening. And I always had to admit that I didn't. And I think that's partly because, you know, it was blanketed in secrecy when it happened, and it happened behind the Iron Curtain. But I always thought, actually, what I do remember very clearly is the Challenger accident, which happened almost 3 months, exactly 3 months earlier in 1986. So that was something that had me thinking about it already. And so then when the time came for me to start thinking about what I wanted to write about next, I started looking into it. And I realized that although I was 17 when it happened, and so I remember it really vividly, when I began looking into the research and looking into it in more detail, I realized that although I thought I knew all about it, I didn't know half of what had actually happened.
Do you remember where you were and what your thoughts were when the shuttle exploded?
Well, you know, this was a pre-internet, pre-cell phone time. And because of the time difference, I was in England in high school. And I just finished the school day, and then I went out with my friends after school. And it wasn't until I got home late that night that my mother told me about it, because she'd seen it on the news. And I remember how kind of totally unthinkable it was that something like that could have happened, and how difficult I found it to comprehend that it had.
I think one thing that your book then educates us about, if not reminds us, is that space travel was and still is extraordinarily hazardous. You know, the idea of just lifting a tube of metal with some people into the sky doesn't seem to be, even by 1980 standards, that difficult a task. And yet you spend page after page explaining to us why it's so dangerous and daunting. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that's part of why the accident, when it happened, you know, seemed to be so shattering and so transformative for the way in which Americans saw themselves and the project of NASA, is because by 1986, the agency had really succeeded in making it seem as if, you know, space travel really had become quotidian. Because the whole purpose, the whole selling point of the space shuttle was that this was something that wasn't going to be like sending astronauts to the moon, where, you know, it seemed like something that was always on the edge of disaster. It seemed like something that was very dangerous, self-evidently. The idea with the space shuttle was that it was going to be the world's first reusable spacecraft that could take off like a rocket, go into space like a spacecraft, but then crucially come back down to Earth and land on a runway just like an aeroplane, and then be ready to do it again, you know, a few days later. They kind of bring it back to Earth, they'd wipe down the windshield, they change the oil, they put a new crew aboard, and then off it would go again. And that was profoundly misleading. You know, the engineers and the astronauts who worked on the shuttle program all knew that this was an experimental spacecraft, and what they were doing was extraordinarily risky. But the way it was presented to the public was that it was little different from flying on an airplane. And that's something that eventually led into the Teacher in Space program. You know, this was a spacecraft that was so safe, and space travel had become so routine that you could send a civilian up any real risk.
And that ambitious sort of timeline, once a week, was actually sort of the math they needed to justify the cost, right? I mean, there were political and economic pressures from the get-go, weren't there?
Yes, because the one of the sort of original sins of the shuttle program was that the political will from Congress and from the White House and public interest in the space program, to be honest, just wasn't there after the moon landings were complete, especially in a country where, you know, by the early 70s, there was galloping inflation, there was the tremendous costs of the war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. of the Great Society program, all of these other things that meant that the economic picture was completely changed from how it was when Kennedy announced the ambition to go to the moon at the beginning of the 60s. You know, it meant that they were given a budget that was far too small to do something as ambitious as build the world's first reusable spacecraft.
You know, one of the interesting things is that I think we do remember a few things about it. The shape of it, that big orange tank that was bolted to the underbelly of the spacecraft. The word O-ring the words O-rings we all started to hear a little bit about. And those tiles that were affixed to the outside that formed the heat shield. And you mm-hmm. tell the story about how they had to then literally blanket the thing with these. And then when they came to affix them, they realized that since there's a curve in the shape of the spacecraft and the tiles didn't curve naturally, they had to do what?
The root of the problem really was that they initially imagined that every one of these tiles was just going to be the same, essentially. But there were 32,000 of them. And so they were going to form this continuous heat shield all around the fuselage of the space shuttle, the part of the shuttle structure that looked the most like an airplane. But when they, like you say, when they came to actually do it, they realized that the contours of the shuttle were such that actually, as it turned out, they couldn't all be the same. In fact, they all had to be completely unique. And then they had to glue every single one of these 32,000 tiles on the surface of the shuttle by hand, which they did. But then when they began testing, they figured out that actually the glue didn't hold them on properly. So they had to take almost all of them off, do a whole series of other tests, devise a totally new way of fixing them to the surface of the shuttle, and start all over again.
And all of this is necessary because the heat upon re-entry would be so great that otherwise the ship would burn up, right?
Yes, because one of the key parameters of launching any kind of spacecraft is the weight. You've got to try and keep the weight down so it weighs as little as possible, and then you can carry more payload into space. You need less thrust to get it into space. So they built the airframe of the superstructure of the shuttle from aluminum. But if aluminum was exposed to the kind of heat that the shuttle would experience as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, thousands of degrees Fahrenheit, then it would begin to soften and melt, and eventually it would just kind of liquefy and run like hot butter.
So they had to get past all of these things. And on page 98, you were talking about the fact that the shuttle was designed to carry 390,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen fuel and 145,000 gallons of supercooled liquid oxygen held to temperatures approaching absolute zero inside its giant external tank. But then you say, drawing the fuel and oxidizer into each of the main engines was a pair of high-pressure turbopumps designed to force the two liquids together into a combustible mixture, burning at 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the boiling point of iron. So you've got something that's at absolute zero frozen cold, In an instant, it's turned to something so hot it would melt iron. The engines consumed fuel so voraciously that the pumps were capable of draining the entire contents of a backyard swimming pool in less than half a minute. The size and weight limitations meant that each pump, this is one of my favorite sentences, driving turbines spinning at more than 500 revolutions a second, generated pressures of almost 450 atmospheres, enough to shoot a jet of liquid hydrogen 36 miles into the air. All of that engineering and science packed into the belly of this thing. Who knew? It looked like an airplane. It's just fantastic to think of the challenges that they faced and that they did find a means to overcome them.
Right, well, but this is the thing, is that it was an extraordinary achievement. And that was one of the things that made me want to revisit the story in the first place, is because, you know, it became clear to me after all this time, you know, the two accidents that destroyed shuttles, the Challenger accident in 86 and then the Columbia accident in 2003, you know, have served over the years to so thoroughly overshadow the history of the shuttle program that people now, you know, forget that it was this amazing achievement, and it was absolutely incredible that they got it to fly in the first place. And the things that were achieved in the years leading up to 1986, like Bruce McCandless flying free in orbit in the spacesuit that was, you know, like powered by a jetpack, and was the front page image of newspapers all over the world. You know, all of those things about the shuttle program have really been lost to time as a result of the accidents. So I really wanted to make clear with the book what a kind of astonishing achievement it was in the first place.
One of the trips, they launched a couple of satellites, and then everything malfunctioned. They lost track of them. So then another shuttle mission goes up, and they're going to race those things down, grab them, pull them back in, bring them back to Earth, and fix them and send them back up again. And that was seen as almost an impossible task. Do I recall correctly? They pulled that off, right?
Well, not only was it seen as an almost impossible task, but they improvised the solution to do it essentially at the last minute. They just decided that they were going to reassign the mission of one future launch that they had mere months away from its original purpose to going up and retrieving these satellites. And you're right. They actually, you know, the crew was so lacked such confidence in the idea that this almost impossible task could be pulled off that even on the verge of the flight lifting off, they were saying that if they got one, it would be extremely unlikely, and if they got two, it would be a total miracle.
Then they were out there floating in space, and they grabbed the hold of this thing. And now, me like trying to get my golf clubs in the back of my trunk, they realize the satellite is bigger than the cargo bay, or they're having trouble getting it in, right?
Yes, because the actual satellites as built didn't match up to the blueprints from the manufacturer, and they didn't discover this until they manhandled it right outside the shuttle cargo bay to try and bring it back. Yeah. They thought they were, you know, home and dry, and then they discovered it didn't fit.
Something you could have told me yesterday. So now they're floating in space, but son of a gun if they didn't get the thing in. So hooray for all of that. And yet, the shadow that hangs over the book, we know how it will end, and they should have known better along the way, is that there were problems. It was the seals between the different components of the rocket itself, not just the O-rings, but particularly those. So what was the problem that was kind of hanging over the space shuttle from one to the last one?
Well, the problem that you're talking about is that the solid rocket boosters, which are these twin rockets that run up the side of the external tank that you mentioned, and provided the majority of the thrust that would take the shuttle to the edge of orbit, had not worked as designed from the minute they were first built. And they had shown a propensity to leak at these joints because the rockets were so massive. They were the largest solid rockets ever built at that point. They're 150 feet high. And so they were so large that they couldn't be built in a single monolithic case. They had to be built in segments, and those segments were then put on rail cars and shipped across the country from the manufacturer in northern Utah to Florida, to the Kennedy Space Center, where they were then kind of stacked up one segment on top of another and bolted together to go out to the launch pad ready for launch. But the key part of this was that the segments had to fit together in a way that was completely gas tight, because if any of the gases of combustion from the rocket fuel inside the casings leaked out of any of the joints at any point, for even a fraction of a second, a leak could start coming out through the hole, and then within a few seconds, even a leak, you know, the width of a pencil, could just cut through the casing like a knife through hot butter. And then the rocket would come apart in flight, the external tank would disintegrate, and the entire shuttle stack would disintegrate in flight, which is ultimately what happened.
Some of the engineers realized this, either in testing or in flights previous to Challenger. They would then take apart the rockets to see how it handled, and they could see that these O-rings were burning through and that the secondary ring was sometimes challenged. Why didn't they pay more attention to that? Why didn't they anticipate that this ultimately would lead to a catastrophe?
Because when they initially noticed this, the leaks around the O-rings, which were these artificial rubber seals that went around the circumference of the rocket to make sure that these joints between the segments were gas tight, they discovered that there was charring and vaporization in these seals right from the second shuttle flight in 1981. But they conducted a series of tests initially because they were so concerned about it, and they satisfied themselves that even though the rings did not behave as they were designed to behave, they were nonetheless still within their safety parameters. And they continued to satisfy themselves that they understood why these leaks were happening and that they weren't ultimately that dangerous, even as the nature of the leaks grew worse and worse over the years the shuttle continued to fly. And the real turning point was when there was a launch at the beginning of 1985, which was in extraordinarily cold weather. At that point, it was the coldest weather in Florida history. And the engineers who dismantled the solid rockets when they were recovered from that flight afterwards noticed that the worst of the leaks had happened on that flight. And so one engineer in particular became concerned that cold weather exacerbated the existing problem with the O-rings. And he tried to have flights stopped or slowed while they fixed the problem. But in the end, he was convinced by his superiors that this was a one-off weather event. This was a kind of freak meteorological incident. It was the coldest weather in Florida history. So it was a once-in-a-hundred-year event. And so they'd have plenty of time to keep working on trying to resolve this pre-existing problem with the O-rings before, you know, the weather was ever that cold again. Mm-hmm. Almost exactly a year later, right, these same engineers heard the weather forecasts that they'd received details of from Cape Canaveral before the Challenger flight. And those weather forecasts said that, once again, there was a cold weather event that was going to be a once-in-a-hundred-year cold snap. So it was once again going to be the coldest weather in Florida history. And at that point, those guys tried to stop the launch taking place.
Below this temperature, we shouldn't fly. What was it, like 50 degrees or something like that?
It was 53 degrees, because that was the temperature that the flight in 1985 had taken off after.
53.
And so they reasoned that if it went any further down the thermometer than that, then they were facing a potential catastrophe. Because they knew that they'd narrowly escaped disaster in January 1985. So they tried to set this as the floor of the temperature below which they should not launch.
And what was the temperature the day they did launch?
That the lowest temperature that was reached on the pad was somewhere around 27 degrees Fahrenheit the night before the actual launch.
Think about that. And if it wasn't that one, it was the one previous to that. But then one of the engineers walked around the shuttle with a temperature gun, and near one of the lower nozzles on the bottom of the rocket ship there, he recorded a reading of 8 degrees. And so it was just this super cold cell of damn the bad luck weather that descended upon the launch pad. And then this is maybe the scene in the movie where the music starts to ratchet up, because if you think about how many billions of dollars are at stake here for the engineering companies and the rocket manufacturers, and then the political pressure on NASA and all of these people and all of this money and all of these companies all come together to make this thing happen. And doggone it, we got the teacher in space on the pad here. We've got to get this thing launched. And yet there's just this one or two engineers and they're going, guys, we shouldn't do it. You do get a sense of the enormous pressure to just say, oh, no, wait, we can't do it today. It's too cold. That seems weak or feeble or just too much of a sidestep when we need to keep going forward. Morton Thiokol, the rocket manufacturer, now has another competitor entering the business, maybe. And if we can't get these things launched regularly and safely, then maybe they're going to give the money to somebody else. The night before the launch, they have a teleconference, right?
That's the point at which the Morton Thiokol engineers who've been working on trying to get these joints fixed for the preceding several years, they make a written recommendation to NASA that they delay the launch. So they say that given the choice between a go and a no-go, it is a no-go for launch. And they present the data that they have, although they're aware of the fact that the data that they have on the connection between low temperatures and leaks in the rockets is far from conclusive. They think that in this presentation they give them during this teleconference that they've made a convincing argument that they should at least delay the launch, if not call it off completely. But what happens is that NASA, under all of these pressures that you're talking about, political pressure, pressure from the press, they've already delayed the launch several times. It's growing increasingly embarrassing. And there's a lot of pressure surrounding the publicity from the Teacher in Space launch. NASA make it clear that they really don't want to hear this recommendation, that they want to press ahead with a launch. They don't explicitly say that, but they don't need to. They make it clear in the way that they react to this written recommendation not to launch that they want them to change their minds. And so when they pick up on this, the senior executives at Morton Thiokol, who are also aware of the fact that they have a separate meeting with NASA the following morning about the idea that the solid rocket booster contract might be opened up to competition, yeah, from one of their nearest competitors in the solid rocket business, they ask for a pause in the teleconference. They ask to go offline for a few minutes to talk amongst themselves for 5 minutes. And then this 5 minutes recess expands into half an hour, during which, while they're offline, the three senior executives in the room who are in charge confront the engineers and just say, well, we think that we should change our minds. We think we should change our recommendation from no-go to go. And once again, Roger Beaujolais, who's one of the engineers who's been trying to persuade them to stop the launch from the outset, you know, they do their best to present them with the arguments of why they think that this is going to be extremely dangerous and that they'll be facing a complete catastrophe. They're unsuccessful. And in the end, all of the senior executives in the room vote to change their recommendation. And so they go back online and then eventually agree to sign a recommendation to launch. And then the launch goes ahead the following day.
Yeah. 14 engineers, I think, was the number. All said no. And then, badgered as they were, they said, okay, fine. It's not an engineering decision. It's a management decision. And the pressures are greater than the engineering danger, we think. So just talk a little bit about Christa McAuliffe.
So Christa McAuliffe was the teacher from New Hampshire who was ultimately selected as NASA's teacher in space. And she was a kind of extraordinary personality. She was selected at least partly because she was such a wonderful communicator of both her own enthusiasm about the space program and what it meant to kids and school children around the country. NASA had selected her after what was essentially a sort of 9-month-long talent competition. And the finalists, of whom were sent to Washington, D.C. to be interviewed by a panel of experts that included Gene Cernan, who was the last man to walk on the moon at that point, and Pam Dorber, who played Mindy in Mork and Mindy. So it was this kind of extraordinary kind of exercise in fantastic publicity for NASA. But she was also this wonderful personality, was kind of who then featured on the covers of magazines, and then she was on the Tonight Show. She, you know, was really taken to the hearts of people around the country, and really got on well, I think, with the other six members of the crew of Challenger.
Including Judy Resnick and some of the others who sort of looked at her as though you're the passenger. You're not a fighter pilot. You're not a scientist like we are. But they all came to appreciate her, it seemed, although they had to eat some humble pie, because every time they'd march all seven of them out there, every question in the room was for the teacher, not the rest of these very accomplished people.
Yeah, certainly some of the astronauts in the program initially kind of resented the idea of this, of the whole idea of this civilians in space program, because they recognized that, you know, there was enormous competition for each of the seats on board every shuttle mission, and that if a civilian was going to be drafted in with so little training, because it lasted less than a year, the amount of preparation they were given before these flights, then those seats were going to be taken away from fully qualified astronauts, their own colleagues, who trained for decades, in some cases, for these missions.
Not that an upstart congressman himself didn't himself put himself on the previous flight and then ended up bumping some of the astronauts. Some of the people that were on board, I think, on Challenger were there as a result of that Florida congressman getting on a previous flight, right?
Yes, Greg Jarvis, who was on the Challenger flight, had been bumped off previous flights by politicians.
The astronauts themselves did not know about the history of the O-rings, did they?
No, they certainly didn't know the kind of detail of the O-ring erosion, is what they called it, and the problems with the joints in any detail. I mean, these things had come up in what they called flight readiness reviews, which are the sort of chain of preparatory meetings they had leading up to every launch of the shuttle. But it was never represented as if it was any sort of big deal. And in amongst the thicket of all the other problems and problems that needed to be resolved before a launch, it never seemed to jump out at any of them.
The launch goes off. What happens in that 73 seconds?
Well, it was exactly what Roger Beaujolais feared would happen, which was that a leak began in one of the rubber O-rings of one of the sections of the solid rocket. And that leak initially kind of sealed itself in the first few seconds after ignition on the launch pad. But then as the shuttle went through the period of maximum dynamic stress on the airframe of the shuttle at around a minute into flight, the leak sprang again. And then at that point, this, you know, finger of super hot gas began to burn through the casing. And exactly what Beaujolais feared would happen happened, which was that the hole grew larger and larger, and flames from inside the solid rocket made contact with the outside of the external fuel tank and burned a hole in the fuel tank. And then the fuel tank came apart. And then what you see in the footage that was screened, you know, on that day over and over again on TV, was not actually an explosion, but all of the super cold gas inside the fuel tank escaping and then catching fire in the sky. And so that's a huge fireball. And the space shuttle itself, as the rockets part from the external tank and from the shuttle, then the rocket was just torn apart by aerodynamic forces of flying out of true at such a high speed.
So the cabin stayed intact, right?
The cabin flew free from the wreckage and then continued up towards its apogee. And there's evidence that suggests that the gravitational forces that tore apart the shuttle were not sufficient to render the crew unconscious, and that they may have survived not only the disintegration of the spacecraft, but also the fall of the crew compartment, which remained intact until it hit the surface of the ocean.
Your book with notes and epilogue runs over 500 pages. You don't take us to this point of the story until the 350th page. You're begging our patience here, sir, but it's so well written that you don't mind. But I wonder if you worried as you wrote about it, like cut to the chase already. Trust me, I was patient with every page. I read many of them more than once. But why did you wait so long to get to essentially the last few chapters of the book about the actual demise of the crew?
Because it was very important to show who each member of that crew was as a person, to understand how they got to that point, why they got to that point, but also to show how the engineers who had built the shuttle felt about building it and about what they were doing, and show the chain of events that led up to the catastrophe. Because you can write a book about what happened on January the 28th, 1986, and make it very short. And there's a few of those books out there. But it just seems bewildering when you read the story, when it's framed that way, because it seems totally inexplicable. It seems like what you've got is a group of incredibly reckless engineers at NASA and at their contractors, and that you've got a series of and you've got seven kind of ignorant martyrs who went to their deaths not knowing the dangers of the spacecraft they were riding on. And none of those things is true. You know, it's a much more subtle story than that. And in order to really appreciate not only what happened on that day, but what was lost, not only within NASA and obviously within the families of the astronauts who died, but also as a country, you need to understand, you know, all of the foregoing.
Well, this is a book as much about the engineers and the engineering as it is the astronauts in that 73-second flight. You did not dwell on how those people, though, did die.
You know, the final words that are recorded on the tape were at a fraction of a second before the disintegration took place. And at that point, those cockpit recorders were cut off from their power supply. So if any words were spoken after that point, we don't know anything about it. There's no evidence to support anything that anybody would say about words spoken in the cockpit after that.
Am I confusing it then with Columbia? Because I was reading the Times review of your book, and it does talk a little bit about the fact that at least one of the astronauts may well have been alive all the way until impact.
That's true, but that's not based on evidence from the voice recorder or from any spoken words. It's from the fact that settings within the cockpit of the shuttle were changed after the disintegration. They were changed from their ascent settings. And also there was breathing equipment that was turned on that would only have been turned on after an accident had happened.
Right, right.
And that the supply of oxygen from within that equipment had been used up to a degree that almost exactly matches the 2 minutes and 45 seconds it took for the shuttle cockpit, the self-contained capsule that broke free containing the astronauts, to fall from the point at which it disintegrated to the surface of the ocean.
And then, of course, the last part of a story like this then is the almost immediate investigations that took place. Just a last word from you about how those went.
I think that, you know, one of the most impressive things about the investigation that took place was its transparency. Because William Rogers, who was put in charge of the inquiry, determined right at the beginning that they didn't want to make the same mistakes that had been made by the inquiry into the assassination of JFK, when they published a report, but all of their investigative materials had been kept secret. And that's something that proved the germination of all of these conspiracy theories that continue to circulate to this day, so many years after the shooting. So Rogers said that what they would do is they would conduct their investigation, they would publish the report, and then the day the report was published, they would place all of their investigative materials, transcripts of all of the interviews, all of the documents they gathered, everything would go to the National Archives. So that's one of the things that made it possible to write this book, was that all of that material is there if you want it. So they, you know, for instance, they went off and interviewed all of the dozens of people who were sitting in on that teleconference the night before the accident. And the investigators interviewed everybody about every facet of that conversation. So that was something that enabled me to reconstruct everything, you know, in a way that places the reader there in the rooms.
It's a dramatic scene at the testimony, too, isn't it? Because all of those engineers who had rather, I use the word badgered, but into compliance with the message from Morton Thiokol, okay, we're a go. We don't want to lose this contract. This is embarrassing. Okay, we're going to go ahead and light that candle. And then when they have the hearing about what happened, the strategy from the higher-ups at the company was to be as obsequious as possible, to answer questions very briefly, don't offer any extra information. And they were told at the outset, we want the full story. Don't hide anything back. And some of the engineers who knew the full story and who were screaming about the O-rings for months and years were sitting there watching this happen. And so then finally, one of them who isn't called on sort of stands up and he's waving his hands like, hey, I don't know if I'm supposed to speak, but you got to hear my story.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what happened. I mean, it's one of the reasons the book is subtitled the way it is. And you know, I've seen some readers have written reviews where they say, well, I don't know how much heroism is involved because, you know, this flight disintegrated 73 seconds after liftoff. You know, the astronauts didn't know what was going on. To which I would say, well, there's two things here. One is that, you know, anyone who climbs aboard the space shuttle knowing how dangerous it is, that, you know, that's true heroism. But two, you know, those guys that you were talking about, Alan MacDonald and Roger Beaujolais from Morton Thiokol, are real heroes because they're the people who stood up when they knew that it would certainly damage their own careers, the careers of their colleagues, and the reputation of their company, to stand up and speak the truth about what had really happened when their bosses were trying to cover it up, and went ahead nonetheless.
Are there movie rights to this? Did I miss something here? What's going on with the book itself?
Oh, yeah, that the book comes out in paperback in January in time for the 40th anniversary, and it's being developed as a TV show at the moment.
Oh, no kidding, a TV show, like a Netflix thing?
Something like that, yeah. It's in those, you know, early stages where they're working on a script, and, you know, it may never happen.
In other words, none of my business right now.
No, I can't tell you because they haven't announced it yet.
Because I'm already casting the things. but you know what? We don't need the movie or TV show. The book is terrific. Adam, a lot of your time this afternoon, but thank you so much. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for sharing this with us.
Not at all. Thanks, John. I really appreciate having me on.